Good evening. President Trump says you're fired to National Security Advisor John Bolton.
The president's entitled to the staff that he wants at any moment. This is a staff person who works directly for the president of the United States, and he should have people that he trusts and values and whose efforts and judgments benefit him in delivering American foreign policy.
And 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg describes her journey to action and talks openly about her autism.
I am different from everyone else, and it is thanks to my diagnosis, my Asperger's syndrome, and because without that I wouldn't have noticed this crisis.
And the Lower East Side gets an independent review of its climate change resiliency project. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Tuesday, September 10th, 2019. President Donald Trump forced out National Security Advisor John Bolton on Tuesday. The two have had significant disagreements on Iran, Afghanistan, and a cascade of other global challenges. They offered opposing accounts on Bolton's less-than-friendly departure. What had been a fractious relationship almost from the start. Trump tweeted that he told Bolton Monday night his services were no longer needed at the White House, and Bolton submitted his resignation Tuesday morning. Bolton responded in a tweet of his own that he offered to resign Monday, and President Trump said, "Let's talk about it tomorrow." Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin addressed Bolton's leaving at a news conference that was supposed to have included him.
The president's entitled to the staff that he wants at any moment. This is a staff person who works directly for the president of the United States, and he should have people that he trusts and values and whose efforts and judgments benefit him in delivering American foreign policy. It's what, as cabinet member, Secretary Mnuchin and I try and do each and every day. And when the president makes a decision like this, he's well within his rights to do so.
Secretary Pompeo, can you describe your working relationship with John Bolton as it was today?
Sure.
And also,
sure.
Does his departure make it easier for you to do your job and for the administration to accomplish the president's foreign policy agenda?
Look, I don't talk about the inner workings of how this all goes. We all give our candid opinions. There were many times Ambassador Bolton and I disagreed, that's to be sure. But that's true for lots of people with whom I interact. My mission set is always to make sure, as I run the Department of State, is to deliver America's diplomacy. And to work with the team, whether it's a Treasury or the president's staff, to make sure we get good outcomes. I know everyone's talked about this for an awfully long time. There were definitely places that Ambassador and I, Bolton and I, had different views about how we should proceed.
Is it now possible to see some less hawkish Iran policy, and does this open the path for the president to meet with Rouhani?
I would say Secretary Pompeo and myself and the president are completely aligned on our maximum pressure campaign. I think you know we've done more sanctions on Iran than anybody, and it's absolutely working. Now, the president has made clear he's happy to take a meeting with no preconditions, but we are maintaining the maximum pressure campaign.
Mr. Secretary Pompeo, for clarity on this, can you foresee a meeting between President Trump and the Iranian leader later this month surrounding the United Nations?
Sure.
Would the president support that, and do you support that actively?
The president's made very clear he's prepared to meet with no preconditions.
Just to follow up quickly on the original guidance for this briefing, Bolton was on the guidance to be here. So were you two blindsided by what occurred today, that he's no longer with the administration? Was it news to you today? Because last night you were told he would be here today.
Yeah, I'm never surprised.
Well, let me ask you this.
And I don't mean that on just this issue. And I think Secretary Mnuchin would say the same thing. We work very closely with the President of the United States. I think we have a pretty good understanding of how he's thinking about things. I think you'd agree, Stephen, at nearly all times. And so, our mission sets not to talk about these inner workings in the palace intrigue that I know you are so curious about, but rather to talk about the things that matter to American foreign policy.
The White House says that National Security Advisor Bolton's foreign policy was not aligned with the president's philosophy. How was it out of alignment?
Well, I'll leave that to the White House to talk about. Other than to say, I think President Trump, I watched his campaign. I've now worked with him first as CIA director and now as Secretary of State. Someone asked, would the policy be different absent any individual being here? These have been the president's policies. We give him our best wisdom. We share with him our understanding. When I was intelligence director, we did our best to make sure he had the facts and data available so he could make good decisions. But I don't think any leader around the world should make any assumption that because someone of us departs, that President Trump's foreign policy will change in a material way.
And that's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. White House spokesman Hogan Gidley said Charles Koperman, the deputy national security advisor and a former Reagan administration official and defense contracting executive, would fill Bolton's role on an acting basis.
The acting national security advisor is Charlie Koperman. And the fact is, the President of the United States asked John Bolton last night for his resignation. It was delivered today. John Bolton's priorities and policies just don't line up with the president's. And any sitting president has the right to put someone in that position that can carry out his agenda. That became no longer tenable, so the president made a change.
Bolton was named Trump's third national security advisor in March 2018 after the departure of Army General H.R. McMaster. Pompeo also briefly addressed an issue first reported by CNN that an American spy in Moscow was forced to leave his job because of statements made by Trump. The report suggested the spy was endangered after sensitive information was released by Trump in a conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Thank you, sir. There are reports this week that the CIA had to pull a top Russian asset out because of concerns that his identity could be exposed. Under which administration was this source burned, and is there currently an investigation into how his identity got leaked to the media?
Yeah, I've seen that reporting. The reporting is materially inaccurate. And you should know, as the former CIA director, I don't talk about things like this very often. It is only the occasions when there's something that I think puts people at risk, or the reporting is so egregious as to create enormous risk to the United States of America, that I even comment in the way that I just did. And I won't say anything more about it. I know the CIA put out a statement. Suffice to say that the reporting there is factually wrong.
Stephen L. Hall, a former CIA official, told the New York Times, "We have a president who, unlike any other president in modern history, is willing to use sensitive classified intelligence however he sees fit. He does it in front of our adversaries. He does it by tweet. We are in uncharted waters." And Jim Loeb, who was the Washington Bureau Chief for Interpress News Service and is the editor of the Loeb blog, which is hosted by the Institute for Policy Studies, says Trump's decision to fire John Bolton was a good one and in the interest of peace.
Well, I personally think it's a huge relief because if ever there was somebody who favored military conflict and kind of a aggressive Jacksonian nationalism in Trump's administration or in any Republican administration, it was John Bolton. Bolton has always been an extremist. He originates from the right of the spectrum, so he's not a true neoconservative, but he's adopted many neoconservative ideas over time, but I think correctly insists that he's fundamentally a nationalist. And extremely aggressive and belligerent and a very dangerous man, particularly in the national security advisor position.
Could you define a little bit, what do you mean by Jacksonian, and what do you mean by he's to the right, or he comes from something to the right of neoconservatives? What does that mean?
Neoconservatives tend to have kind of a liberal ideology, especially domestically. They tend to be extremely Israel-centered in the way they look at foreign policy, and that protection of Israel is absolutely important. Bolton came to share those views, but whether he did so out of kind of conviction or out of political expediency, I think, is very much a question. The kind of aggressive nationalist position that Bolton represents and has promoted over the years, and neoconservatives have worked together for quite some time.
And what do you think Trump broke with Bolton? Because they seem to be getting along well, and then boom, what happened?
On our blog today, we have a post by Paul Pillar, who is the a former very senior CIA analyst for many years, and indeed was the national intelligence officer for the Near East and South Asia from 2000 and 2005. And he kind of argued that there was a fundamental contradiction between Trump as a deal maker and Bolton as having a history and taking pride in his reputation as a deal breaker, so that there was actually something that essentially made it difficult for the two to be reconciled in any strategic sense. And obviously, I think Bolton's strong opposition to any deal with the Taliban, let alone at Camp David, was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. But it's clear that he also very much opposed any kind of concession vis-a-vis North Korea from the outset, virtually. And that was clearly a point of contention, and Trump had already kind of sidelined him on North Korea. And to some extent, I mean, it's very difficult to fathom what Trump's views of Iran are and what the administration's view, because they contradict each other. That is, key members of the administration contradict each other's on Iran virtually on a daily basis, with the State Department sticking with the notion of Pompeo's 12 preconditions for meeting, and then Trump often piping up about how much he would like to meet with Rouhani.
Do you think this is a good decision on Trump's part?
Trump likes to make deals, or he likes to see himself making deals, especially because of the upcoming election. I don't think he wants to get the U.S. in another war. And Bolton was clearly very interested in conflict with Iran and has been pushing for it and trying to paint Trump into a corner on it, along with, incidentally, Mike Pompeo, who remains in office and will probably see his influence enhanced as a result of this. And so the two, I think, were fundamentally incompatible as a deal maker and deal breaker.
Is this going to be a division within the Trump base? Does this reflect that, or is this totally among people in the highest levels?
Well, my impression is that the base is not that focused on foreign policy, and Bolton was exclusively focused on foreign policy. So I would be somewhat surprised if there were major political consequences at the base or at the core of his constituency. On the other hand, there may be lawmakers, particularly in the Senate on the right, for whom this will raise new questions about Trump's competence and where he's going. I mean, you have somebody like Tom Cotton from Arkansas, who's very much on Bolton's side, and this will not make him happy. And that could cause some more confusion. And at the base, I'm not sure they were that focused on Korea or Iran or the things that Bolton really, really cared about.
Jim Loeb was the Washington Bureau Chief for InterPress News Service and is editor of the Loeb blog for the Institute for Policy Studies. And in more, well, by the way, you're listening to the WBAI Evening News, Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And in more national news, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg made an appearance at the University of Chicago on Monday, where she sat down for a conversation with Dean Catherine Baker of the Harris School of Public Policy. They discussed everything from gender discrimination to her status as a cultural icon. Ginsburg also addressed the current politicized and polarized approach to judicial confirmations.
Shows up on both sides of the aisle. My now Chief Justice Roberts had all the qualifications one could want in a Supreme Court justice, a number of negative votes from Democrats. And my excellent colleagues, Sotomayor and Kagan, again, multiple negative votes, divisions along party lines. I don't know what it will take, but we really should get back to the way it was when people were examining the qualifications of someone to be a judge, rather than trying to guess how they would vote on contentious cases. Maybe there'll be great statespeople on both sides of the aisle who will say, enough of this nonsense, let's do the work that we were elected to do for all of the people of the United States. I hope I will see that restoration in my lifetime.
And that was Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And in climate news, a special event in New York City hosted by Intercept senior correspondent Naomi Klein, author of the forthcoming book On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, and headlined by trailblazing climate activist Greta Thunberg, author of No One Is Too Small to Make a Difference, was held Monday night at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Thunberg arrived in New York after a ride across the Atlantic on a sailboat. She said on board is when she first heard that the Amazon forest was burning.
One of the people on the boat, his wife called on the satellite phone and explained that the Amazon is on fire. And right after that call, he called for everyone else of us and said, like, the Amazon is burning. And that it was serious and it was... And it was just so shocking, and it was so hard to realize, because being on the ocean, you cannot do anything, you cannot impact in any way, you cannot do anything about it. You just have to sit there, and it was horrible to sort of the knowledge of that. But and then when I came to shore, it was the first time I could see pictures of it and to really find out the details about it. And it was, I remember that was one of the first things I did when I came to shore.
Klein asked the youthful climate activist about how she deals with sometimes vicious attacks by right-wing climate change deniers.
I don't know how many laugh attacks I have had just watching these tweets. And sometimes I have like a competition with myself to find the most absurd conspiracy theory.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's sometimes tough because they're also, because they go after like things like my personality and how I am, how I look, how I behave, and I mean that is just a sign that you are winning, and that they don't have any more arguments.
And in a touching moment, Thunberg, who has long posted on her online bio that she has Asperger's syndrome, basically a mild case of autism, described how her diagnosis helped her focus on the climate crisis.
I am different from everyone else, and it is thanks to my diagnosis, my Asperger's syndrome, and because without that, I wouldn't have noticed this crisis. I remember because everyone else, they saw the same thing, they saw the same pictures and films as I did, the destruction of nature and what was happening with the climate, but no one of them seemed to really, I didn't understand why their lives wasn't turned upside down like mine was. And that in the climate, in the fight against the climate crisis, there are a lot of people who are on the autism spectrum, and that is, of course, that cannot just be a coincidence. I think it has something to do with as we walk the walk, and we. I mean, we don't have the distance from what we know and what we say to what we do and how we act is not that far, but to normal people it is. They cognitive dissonance, and I can't, for example, understand that someone can say, like, yeah, climate change is very important, and then not do anything about it. Because if you know how important it is, then you know that you also have to do something, that you also have a responsibility to do something.
Greta Thunberg, the youthful climate activist who is in New York. She was speaking last night at the Society for Ethical Culture. And meanwhile, in New York City, climate change has been having a tremendous impact on local politics, especially the Lower East Side. The $1.3 billion plan to reshape a swath of Lower Manhattan's East Side waterfront with flood protections will get an independent review ahead of a pivotal land use vote. Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer and City Council Member Carlina Rivera announced Monday that they have heeded locals' calls for an outside expert to assess the East Side Coastal Resiliency Project, hiring Hans Gerold of the Dutch environmental consulting group Deltares. Manhattan Borough President Brewer had this to say to WBAI earlier today.
East Side Coastal Resiliency Project really means that the city is suggesting that from 25th Street down to Montgomery, where there is a park along the East River, the city is suggesting that the park be elevated 8 feet in order to make sure that in the future, if there is a surge in terms of water or any kind of a major storm, the water doesn't come into the community as it did during Sandy. That's the quickest version of what is being proposed by the City of New York. Of course, there's lots of details in that, and it is a $1.04 or $5 billion project. The way that this is being decided is uniform land use review procedure. It has to go through a community zoning procedure. And the next date that is of concern is September 23rd, which is when the City Planning Commission will vote on this project. The community board has voted, and the Manhattan Borough President's office, my office, has voted. And now it's up to the City Planning Commission, and then, oh, maybe a couple of months after that, a little bit less, the City Council will vote on the same project. So that's what's going on in terms of the time frame.
Now, there was opposition to that. People felt that they had another plan, and this was changed by the mayor's office. I believe a deputy mayor was involved in that, and it happened. It was sort of an October surprise to a lot of people, stirring up a lot of opposition, and there's you've been dealing with that in different ways.
Absolutely. And we did have a hearing, as did the community board. We had a very lively and excellent hearing as part of our process. Way back when Bloomberg was still the mayor, the federal government gave funding, around $350 million, a little bit less, to the project. And the rest has been supplemented by the City of New York. Of course, when the 300 and something million dollars was given to the City of New York for this project, it was a completely different project. And so all of a sudden there was a change. I must admit, we're still not clear why the change took place. So as we sit here today on September 10th, 2019, we have a new version of what was considered back then, and we don't quite know how we ended up with such a completely different project. But we do know that, this process is taking place, and because there has been such understandable opposition, on the other hand, there are also people who are for it. There are people who live in the New York City Housing Authority developments who like the idea of this increase in height of the park. And then there are other people who like the old proposal or who just think the park should stay as the same. So there's many different ways that this project is considered. So that's why working with Carlina Rivera, who is a council member, we were fortunate to be able to bring in Dr. Hans Gerels, who is a noted Dutch expert on the issue of resiliency. He works for a large 800-person firm in the Netherlands. They work around the world. And he's here for a week, and then he'll write his report, and he'll have something to us by the 23rd of September to say, again, no preconceived ideas. Good idea, bad idea, should do this, shouldn't do that. Everything is under his auspices that he can produce.
If he were to come out, let's say, against the project with all the momentum to do it, would that actually stop it, or could that cause...
You know, I just don't know. I mean, like you said, we don't know what he's going to say. So we have... I'm one of these people, I wait to see what happens. I have no idea. I do think that there's, you know, lots of... he's meeting with all kinds of people who have different opinions.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to wrap up, folks have told me their fear, their biggest fear that comes out when I talk to people over and over, and you might have got other feelings as well, is that it would be easy to do a slapdash job of sorts with a poor neighborhood like Two Bridges in the Lower East Side, and then put all their attention on $30 trillion or $3 trillion worth of real estate in the Lower Manhattan area.
Well, I'm very concerned that the project, if in fact it goes forward in different versions or any version or even any other project, we do need to think about the resiliency, because water from Sandy, as you know, came in and was detrimental to thousands of Lower East Siders. So something has to get done. I don't know what the right thing is, but something has to get done. I do know that the project, if I have anything to do with it and others, it'll be done correctly. It may not take just 3.5 years. I worry about that also, the time frame. But I don't think it is a, you know, there's so many, there's gentrification going on anyway. I don't think it's going to make much difference. We have that fight that's all over the borough of Manhattan, and I work on it every single day trying to stop it.
Climate change is real. New York City is really facing something that is terrifying and different than we've ever faced before.
I mean, anybody who lives, and I was there partly, but not disturbed like so many friends and colleagues who work here in our office. They had no light. They had no boiler. They helped people walk up and down 30 stories. They helped people with, had no water for days and weeks. They had people in wheelchairs who were stuck in their apartments. It was bad. And I was in the buildings, particularly NYCHA buildings, when like 2 weeks later, nothing had been done. So we don't want that again. That was awful. And yeah, it went far into the Lower East Side.
This is something new. I mean, this is definitely, I don't think any mayor, any city government in hundreds of years of New York, whatever, they dealt with revolutions and civil wars, but they never dealt with this before.
No, and we still have, just so you know, the area around South Street Seaport and the Wall Street area. Right now we have a temporary resiliency proposal, but we don't really have what we need there. So there's a lot of issues to deal with, and of course the other boroughs have similar challenges.
Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, September 10th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Oliver Sampson. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.